From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
The subject of the rage that women are finding in texts by women, the subject of the rage is often the lack of power that women experience, and many works by women seem to me to be exploring the possibilities of power for women. Is there a woman's way of gaining power, or is the fact that women have been deprived of all official forms of power really the definitive fact about their experience?
What is feminist literary criticism? How does it differ from other forms of literary study? Is literature marked by gender? In the first in a series of discussions, Soundings put those and other questions to a group of feminist literary critics: Patricia Spax, Barbara Gittenstein, Joan Stewart, and Deborah Kaplan. Patricia Spax teaches at Yale University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she wrote a book about gossip as a form of literary and social discourse. Barbara Gittenstein is a professor of English at the State University of New York at Oswego, where she directs a program in ethnic studies. Joan Stewart teaches French language and literature at North Carolina State University. She recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she wrote a book about 18th century French women novelists. Deborah Kaplan teaches at George Mason University, where she specializes in 19th century British literary studies. Here is Patricia Spax.
If we're talking about feminist criticism, it seems to me that the place to start is by trying to say what it is that we're talking about. Both the word feminist and the notion of feminist criticism are rather vexed issues. I recently heard a talk by the historian Nancy Cott about the history of the word feminist and of reactions to it, and she demonstrated that in the course of American history there have been several waves of feminism and recurring periods in which feminism was a bad word for people in general, and periods in which it was a good word for people in general. I'm not sure which it is right now. It is in fact the case that women have been writing for a very long time, since the beginning of the novel. In the 18th century, women wrote most of the novels in the 18th century, but they didn't write most of the novels that we now read. And there is a very interesting discrepancy there, because in the 18th century, it was assumed that the people who read novels were women and young people, in other words, not very important people. And the novels that have survived from the 18th century are, by and large, with very few exceptions, the relatively few novels that were written by men. Now, the novels by women are now being rediscovered. That's one of the things that feminist criticism has done in the last 10 years or so. A number of women critics have gone back to the texts of the past and are finding books that simply haven't been read in recent years. I suppose the first of those rediscovered books was The Awakening, which is a phenomenon of publishing. The Awakening is a novel by Kate Chopin, an American writer, published in 1899, and I don't know, about 15 years ago, I guess, a publisher reissued it in paperback and simply sent copies out to people around the country. And now I would say that is virtually a canonized text. It's a book that is taught in a great many American literature courses. But of course, from the point of view of teaching, the only books you can teach, by and large, to undergraduates at any rate, is books that are in print. And the problem of getting books back into print is one of the problems that feminist critics have faced.
Barbara Gittenstein.
There is certainly a very strong feminist, female and feminist voice in contemporary Jewish American literature. And it coincides, the Jewishness of these writers coincides with a self-conscious Jewishness that is a part of Jewish American literature post-Holocaust. Many of these writers presented themselves as women writers and as feminist writers earlier in the century or earlier in their lives. And as they became more aware of themselves as Jews, they began writing as Jewish women also. As far as reading the male texts from a feminist perspective, it is absolutely essential. when you're reading, you can even see the transformation of a writer such as Saul Bellow, beginning from one particular perspective in his attitude towards women, towards a developing response to things that are happening in society. His female characters change. The difference, for instance, between the female characters of Herzog in the mid-60s novel and the female character in Dean's December is striking. Not a particularly, not that the Dean's December female character is the most attractive character we can think of, but she certainly indicates a response by someone who is clearly a sociological novelist, aware of history and sociology, of a creation of a different kind of woman.
Joan Stewart.
I think what Pat says about the discovery of early women writers by contemporary feminist critics is a very important aspect of women's literary studies today. And surely if we have made discoveries, those are the discoveries we're talking about, bringing back to life women writers who were very popular in their own day and who've been forgotten. But I think that what has also happened has been a rereading of texts by early women writers, some texts which never really lost viability, which continued to circulate, and even a few of them which remained in the canon, have been read differently nowadays, and a different content has been discovered in them. What Nancy Miller calls in an article that was published in 1981 in PMLA, she calls the repressed content of these novels, and she talks there about two novels that have been read for many years, more or less constantly. A French novel called La Princesse de Clèves, as well as The Mill on the Floss, and reads them very differently from the way they have been read in the past. And I think that we've seen a lot of that happening, too. I'm thinking of specifically of a French writer, a contemporary writer called Marguerite Duras, who published a novel that was very widely read for years called Moderato Cantabile. It appeared in 1959. And at first, this novel was taken simply to be representative of a new kind of novel, what the French called Le Nouveau Roman, and was read as a characteristic novel of this kind of writing. It was only years later that she began to be read as characteristically, as writing a woman's kind of novel, and she's begun to be thought of now as really the example, the most important example of women's writing in France. And that certainly has to do with the new perceptions of feminist criticism, that they've made possible a different kind of reading.
Patricia Spax.
One text that has been rescued in this way is Jane Eyre, which is a book that every adolescent girl certainly has read for more than 100 years and has read as a kind of romantic fantasy. And of course, it is a romantic fantasy. But in recent years, feminist critics rereading that book have discovered in it an enormous amount of expression of discontent with the female lot. The two aspects of the book that have been re-emphasized, rediscovered, are the mad woman in the attic, the mad first wife of the hero Rochester, which gave the title to one of the most important recent books of feminist criticism by Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar. That mad woman has recently been understood in various ways to express the whole problem of women's rage at their oppression by society, to express the aspect of the repressed in herself. That's what she is doing there, up in the attic, shut in. And Jane's own expressions of discontent, which are quite explicit in the book, but were never noticed before recent years, where she talks about her desire for more imaginative scope and more physical scope than she can possibly have. Those exist as direct statements in the book, but they were simply invisible until very recently.
Barbara Gittenstein.
I think you find, for instance, in the rereading of Emily Dickinson, too, and the new feminist readings, there's the new collection by Suzanne Juhas, the feminist critical collection, adds a new depth of feeling to the rage, to the anger that had been expressed before, and just a woman's perspective, which is perhaps not feminist, but is nevertheless a woman's perspective. It also seems to me that it's who develops the criteria of excellence. And in the major, if the major culture is male and the criteria of excellence is a male-dominated criteria, then it's not only that the publishing houses are owned by men, but it's that what is valued in the culture as good is a male-oriented value. One of the things in my response as a feminist critic to Jewish American literature was simply to insist on the discussion of women writers. When I first began the study of Jewish American literature, it was Saul Bellow, Bernard Malamud, and Philip Roth, and that was it. I was just sure there must be women out there writing, and of course there were plenty. So part of the feminist perspective was simply to find and discuss these women. But also, I found that in reading these, even the canon, quote-unquote, of Bellow, Roth, and Malamud, from a feminist perspective, you could begin to understand the perception by the male society, and certainly the Jewish culture in America is a very male-oriented society, of the woman in the Jewish home.
Deborah Kaplan.
I can think of another example from a British novel that I was reading recently, Middlemarch, which shows, it's sort of ostensible line is that there are limits, and it's done in a very compassionate way, but the novel does suggest that there are real limits on women's lives, and there is this central character, Dorothea, whose life is in some ways tragic because she has epic desires and lives in a time in which such epic desires cannot be played out. There's another character in the novel named Lydgate, a doctor, and we learn fairly early in the novel from the narrator that he had been in love with an actress and used to go during his schoolhood days. He used to go and see her perform, and one night she accidentally slipped during a performance and killed her husband, who was also acting in this performance. Do I have the story right?
That's
so far?
Right, yeah.
Okay. So she kills her husband, and everyone thinks it's an accident, and she gets off. But Lydgate is so in love with her that he follows her away from Paris, confesses his love, asks to marry her, and she tells him that, in fact, she meant to do it. And although it's taking me a long time to tell this story, it's really a very small moment in a very large novel, and it's an anecdote that had been overlooked in that novel, and feminists are now noticing stories like that, stories that are really marginal to the plot of the novel, or ostensibly play a role in the plot, very different than they, if you sort of penetrate the story and think about it for a while, then they might. Anyway, you wonder why there is this story about a woman's a woman murdering her husband in the midst of a novel that has that takes a different line on women's lives, and that's the sort of story that people also are looking at now.
And one of the amazing things is that nobody ever noticed that story before. I mean, it now leaps out of the text.
I think that many feminist critics are, in a sense, detectives, and also of necessity theorists, devising theories that can enable the uncovering of content that is there, but is there in a very complex and indirect way.
I think that's an important point, Deborah, and I think it should be added that there is a lot of controversy in feminist circles about a lot of these texts. Figures like George Eliot and Jane Austen, who have been reread. Some people find one kind of evidence in them, and some people find another. Some people see Jane Austen as a crypto-feminist, a feminist who is not necessarily conscious of what she is doing, but who puts into her text nonetheless the evidence of her discontent. And other people find in Jane Austen, as in George Eliot, evidence of someone who was completely compliant with the society. The feminist movement is asking new questions of the text. It isn't necessarily finding predetermined answers. I mean, not the only thing possible to find in a text is discontent, is what I'm saying.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first in a series of discussions about women's literary studies. The panelists are Patricia Spax of Yale University, Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University, Barbara Gittenstein of the State University of New York at Oswego, and Deborah Kaplan of George Mason University. Patricia Spax and Joan Stewart have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where Professor Spax wrote a book about gossip as a form of literary and social discourse. Professor Stewart worked on a project about French women novelists of the 18th century. Here is Joan Stewart.
I think as an illustration of what Deborah was describing before is the difference between the latent content and the manifest content, I could mention a whole body of novels which I'm presently rereading, 18th century French novels by women writers, where I'm discovering time and again that the novels, some of these novels have remained more or less current and have been read over generations by male writers chiefly, and have been seen to be exemplary novels, novels which are extraordinarily moral, in quotation marks, and which are held up as the kind of novels that one would want young women to read. And yet, when I read these novels, when I reread these novels, I discover that there are extraordinarily powerful statements in them and very compelling fantasies, not only erotic fantasies, but fantasies of power, that beneath the stylized vocabulary, beneath the recurring words like virtue and reason, which we find in so many of these 18th century texts, there are commentaries on adultery, on patricide, on all kinds of fantasies which no one seems to have recognized, and which I think new critical methods, new feminist critical methods, have made it possible for us to see in these novels. For me, the experience of rereading these novels and finding things which I did not set out at all to look for was really an extraordinarily compelling one.
Patricia Spax.
What feminist criticism brings to the text is not so importantly a particular ideology as a way of looking at things. Maybe those two are the same thing, but the way of looking at things is what I would emphasize, the way of looking at things that the feminist point of view produces is a way of finding new meanings in text. It's certainly not a way of overshadowing the text. It's a way of educing something from the text.
Deborah Kaplan.
Isn't it really, in some ways, dangerous to not speculate about, to not be self-conscious about the kind of political act that, say, New Criticism and any other kind of formalist criticism is? It is a political act, and we ought to know what sorts of assumptions underlie that kind of criticism. We happen to know what sorts of assumptions underlie feminist criticism.
Barbara Gittenstein.
It also insists on a linear and homogeneous tradition. New criticism insists on a linear and homogeneous tradition. That's why the text can be autonomous. That's why the person reading the text can read the text as the text speaks, because it's a shared, homogeneous tradition.
You mean, Barbara, that new criticism divorces the text from history?
It argues that history is linear and the reason that the text can be interpreted by itself had to imply that the reader and the writer shared the same past. In feminism, we were discussing earlier, in feminism, there was an autobiographical aspect to the critical attitude, which clearly, if you're speaking autobiographically, by definition, you're not speaking of a homogeneous tradition.
Deborah Kaplan.
I think there's in feminist literary criticism a sense that we are not all the society that produces literature is not a homogeneous society made up of one type of person. Obviously, there are women writers as well as male writers. There are also women of different classes and different races and different ethnic groups, and they will all create literature that differs by virtue of their own sociological and sexual differences. I think that new criticism presupposes, to the extent that it thinks of, and it doesn't really consciously think about this at all, but it presupposes a very stable, very homogeneous social world, a world really of white men.
Joan Stewart.
Perhaps it bears mentioning about the distinction between feminist criticism and other kinds of contemporary criticism, that in fact post-structuralist criticism in general has included feminist criticism as part of its problematic. French feminist thinking is very strongly grounded in long-standing schools, long-standing theoretical schools, in the work of Derrida, in the work of Lacan, Freud, Hegel. So feminist criticism need not necessarily be defined against other schools of criticism, but can be seen as part of the same problematic. I think I'd like to add that about feminist criticism finding something in the text that perhaps wasn't there. It seems to me that what's being done is indeed an act of political intervention, which gives us a richer reading of the text than we might otherwise have, which explores the connections between sexual politics and the evolution of a literary form, between sexual politics and the establishment of the canon, between autobiography and the act of reading, between vocation and provocation.
Barbara Gittinstein.
In that a piece of literature has to, we've accepted that Paradise Lost has changed meaning over the centuries by different literary critics reading it and interpreting it. Why is this a question of denigration when Paradise Lost is interpreted by a feminist, and it's not a question of denigration when it's read by a new critic? I can't answer that question. I don't consider it denigration. It seems to me precisely the same thing. It's part of the literary history of a piece that changes, but Paradise Lost is part of society today, too, our interpretation of it.
Patricia Spax.
I agree, of course, with Barbara that literature is part of society. I would also add that literary criticism is part of society, and that the history of literary criticism, like the history of literature itself, is a history of changing cultures and therefore changing modes of insight. As an example, there are two aspects of Paradise Lost that have been of particular interest to feminist critics. One, the most obvious, is the presentation of the relation between Adam and Eve. And we are told in the text of Paradise Lost that he is for God only and she for God in him. Now, the feminist doesn't say of that, isn't that terrible, he for God only and she for God in him. What the feminist says is, isn't it interesting that Milton, when he imagines the relationship between Adam and Eve, has to imagine it in terms which correspond to the dominant cultural mode of his society. He can't imagine it in any other way. And then the feminist critic might look at the scene in which Eve studies her own reflection in a pool and, in effect, in Milton's presentation, falls in love with herself, falls in love with her image in the pool. And the feminist might comment on the fact that Freud thought of narcissism as one of the defining characteristics of women, and think about what it means that in the male imagination, females are so often associated with narcissism. And then the feminist might think about the great scene in Paradise Lost in which sin is presented as an allegorical figure, and sin is presented in the shape of a monstrous woman who has what is it? Is it dogs or snakes or something terrible going on in her lower regions? And the kind of sexual fear and loathing that is conveyed in that becomes very striking. It seems very strange. It's one of those things that it seems very strange now that nobody noticed before. This is a specific example of something that is there in the text. It's there on the page, this scene of in which sin is presented, and nobody before the feminist critics had called attention to the fact that there might be some significance to the fact that sin is imagined as a woman, and then to the way that she's imagined. The point is that feminist criticism is illuminating something that is genuinely there in the text.
Deborah Kaplan.
I don't think that, I mean, we've now, I think, boxed Pat in a way so that it sounds like she's arguing that that approach to feminist studies is the only approach possible. And we've said things early in our discussion to suggest the range of concerns that feminist literary critics have. One such question that Anglo-American critics in particular are pursuing is what it has meant for women writers to write in cultures in the past centuries when writing was not considered an appropriate activity for women. Where did they get the authority to write in cultures that suggested that women should not be assertive, and you need to be assertive in order to write, should not call attention to themselves, and you inevitably call attention to yourself when you write, so that there's a good deal of study, not only about response to literature, but also a study of the production of literature.
Joan Stewart.
One of the leading advocates of what the French call écriture féminine, the process or the practice of inscribing the female body as text. One of the leading advocates of this is a woman named Hélène Cixous, who published The Laugh of the Medusa a few years ago, Le Rire de la Méduse. And in it, she writes that it's impossible to define a feminine practice of writing. She says that this is an impossibility that will always remain because a feminine practice of writing can't be theorized, enclosed, or encoded, which doesn't mean, she adds, that it doesn't exist. And I think that perhaps the corollary of what she's saying there is applicable to what we're talking about now. A feminine practice of reading does not necessarily, or does not seek to discover any one thing. It seeks to read the text as richly as possible and to ask a whole panoply of questions, including some of them that Deborah Kaplan just mentioned, including also the questions that the French feminist readers would be most likely to ask about whether or not language is gender-marked, whether or not reading and writing are different according to the gender of the practitioner. But there are many, many other questions that can also be asked. So that it's not an effort just to see one thing in a text, but to see many, many things, and to see the relations among them. It's an effort to organize what we know about literature and what we know about a specific text differently.
The program is Soundings. This is Wyan Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. The panelists were Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University, Deborah Kaplan of George Mason University, Barbara Gittenstein of the State University of New York at Oswego, and Patricia Spax of Yale University. Next week on Soundings, Professor Leila Ahmed of the University of Massachusetts joins the panel for part two of Soundings on Women's Literary Studies. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wyan Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first in a series of discussions about women's literary studies. What is feminist literary criticism? What are its premises, and how does it differ from other forms of literary study? Are language and literature marked by gender? A panel of feminist literary critics from Yale University, George Mason University, the State University of New York, and North Carolina State University has some answers and insights. Women's Literary Studies, Part 1, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.